Welcome back. Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are revisiting previous wonderful guests. And my guest this week, one of my favorite people in the field of communication on the planet, just does a lot of really interesting things. If there's a therapeutic modality out there, my guest today, I bet you understands its inner workings because she has spent a lot of time in these fields. And she was also my office mate when we were getting our PhDs at the University of South Florida, which we just figured out was a long time ago. So everybody, welcome back. We're going to talk more about identity today, but from a very different perspective, I think, with Dr. Christine Kiesinger.
Yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, it's been a while since you and I sat in that glass encased office in Tampa, Florida. So give everybody your quick pitch. Tell everybody what you do, because you do speaking, consulting, training, educating, therapeutics. You do a lot.
Yeah, I want to start by saying that I appreciate the podcast so much, and I'm glad you're back, because your podcast has me appreciate our training in at an entirely different level. And so I left academia, full-time academia, in 2018. And the reason I left was because the work that I was doing in organizations was becoming something I quite enjoyed, more so. And so the work that I do in organizations, I work in a lot of different arenas organizationally, leadership mastery. And it's essentially applying interpersonal communication, relational communication to leadership and helping executive teams and leaders up level in that area. Speaking, public speaking, both training others in public speaking, doing public speaking, professional development, especially in the areas of interpersonal conflict resolution, team dynamics. Another part of my business really looks at trauma and how critically important it is to have what I call a trauma-informed organization. Because we understand and we really need to communicate differently when it becomes clear to us that someone is in our presence who's grappling with trauma that's showing up in an interaction. So it's super helpful to have some of that training. And what else? What am I missing?
We got to revisit that one. I've been doing some in a future podcast because I've been doing some work on kind of the woke canceling kind of thing, which I think in some ways is a trauma response from an entire subset of subgroups, which have been traumatized historically by majority cultures. And now they're coming back hard, like they've been given some power. And the majority culture does not know how to adjust. And the minority culture, which is not used to using power in these ways, I think sometimes gets awkward about it. It's a very awkward space. So it's really interesting, but it's trauma-based.
Yeah. I think becoming a trauma-informed organizational culture is going to become as important as diversity, equity, inclusivity, belonging trainings are now.
Yeah, absolutely. It encompasses all of that. Like, how do you, you know, you're not essentially making it for your sins, but you're making it for sins of the past, you know, and crimes and mistreatments of the past. And you've got to accept that if you're going to run an organization, because you're bringing in herds of people who have been through those processes, and you've got to deal with that.
And here's what I think is interesting about trauma. Trauma is more often than not interpersonally inflicted. And it's interpersonally healed or resolved. And so communication is such a powerful tool. Interpersonal communication is such a powerful tool in healing trauma. If I can use those skills in such a conscious and intentional way, there is a chance that I can help you to heal from a trauma that was interpersonally, relationally inflicted.
Well, he didn't use our terminology, but Freud's entire psychoanalytic process is interpersonal communication. He called it the talking cure. And he basically said, if you come and hang out with me and relive these experiences as intensely as you can while talking to me, who's a stable, caring, you know, intelligent person, not here to inflict more trauma, then you heal. You know, neurologically, you find new pathways, you heal bad pathways, but it's an interpersonal communication therapy.
And it's really being or becoming for the person in the way you're relating to them through your communication. It's becoming that safe place, that's that relational space where one is made to feel safe, significant, seen, as if they're in solidarity with you, you know, that sense of belonging and supported.
We'll talk about that, because trauma, the negatives of life, are clearly a massive part of your identity. And for some people, I used to talk about this when I was in the paleo alternative health community. We did bi-monthly meetings where we would have potlucks, lunches, and then we bring in a speaker. And I realized after a while, we were either bringing in a sort of performance speakers who were talking about to healthy communities, taking them up a level, people who are always trying to get to their best performance about whatever. And then on the other side, we were dealing with sickness communities or some type of problematic community, which was dealing with something. And the speakers were so different. And the way that people came to, like, if they came in to say, you know, somebody who had chronic pain, and we bring in a speaker who talked about chronic pain and food or whatever they would, whatever their modality was, we would get all these people in chronic pain who would show up. And I'd be like, this is a chronic pain community where that's such a strong part of their identity. They're not a performance community. Mm-hmm. And so trauma sits right there in that huge swath of life where you've got to deal with the way life traumatizes you and other people and your body and fate. That becomes a major part of your identity, don't you think? Like, you've experienced a lot of this.
Yeah. You know, when you look at, first of all, I think we use the word trauma a lot, and we may not be using it in the correct way, right? So trauma isn't necessarily the event itself.
It's one little production note. You've got a white square. You look like the mask of like the Joker. So we either need to move you.
I think the sunlight is coming in. How's that?
It's coming in. So it's literally splitting you into light and dark.
So it might be moving too. So let me know if that happens again. So an event occurs, you and I might experience the same event together, right? That others might deem, well, that must have been really traumatic. And I may have indeed experienced it that way. My reaction to what happened, you know, I had this sense that I had no power. I had no control. I actually felt like I was in a moment of terror or was terrorized by it. There was a very, very high state of fear and anxiety involved. And you may have experienced it very differently. So without any of the things I just named, and therefore it was not traumatizing for you. So there's an event occurs. It's not that the event itself was trauma. It's how we reacted to, how our nervous systems reacted to that. And I think part of it, then, as it gets sort of integrated into our identity, is how I talk about it and who I talk to about it. And the meaning I make of it, these are all linked to communication and relationship. I mean, perhaps you did not experience the event that you and I experienced together as traumatizing, but then you start to talk with people about it, and they're suddenly recruiting you into this idea that it was trauma. So it's tricky.
Yeah, it is. And this is one of the reasons why I love talking about identity so much. It is super tricky. Like I work, my identity work is in public identity, which is completely different than private identity. They move back and forth. They inform each other, but I'm trying to construct, you know, a public identity for people that does good things for them out in the world with new people. So it's basically an advertising agent for yourself out in the world. But then it's like, is that authentically who you are, or you're presenting like a sales version of you? Does that matter to you? Some people it does, some people it doesn't. But like with trauma, take for example, grad school. Grad school is clearly traumatizing to quite a few people. You and I went through the same PhD program. Were you traumatized by it? I didn't feel traumatized by it. There was moments I was like, really, this is what we're doing? But
No, I was not traumatized. It enhanced my life exponentially, but I know what you mean. And I think that when you're working with someone who has trauma or has experienced post-traumatic stress, before you can do anything, with them or for them, there has to be a settling down of their nervous system. So part of the practice is of dealing with someone in trauma is, how can I communicate with this person? How can I be with them in such a way that I am a regulating force for their nervous system? So I regulate first. I cannot do step two, which is really important, until they're regulated. And step two is relate, right? And that is, I want to try to make a connection with you, because until you're regulated, I can't. Think about it. When the nervous system is so triggered and activated, how difficult it is to connect to another person. And then we can come to reasoning, right? Where we can talk through, like, is there another way to think about this? You sort of do the work of challenging your assumptions that this was traumatic, or can I reframe? Can I tell a different story about it? But it's interesting to me that most people go to go to step three first. Sure. Something bad happens and I want to sit you down and I want to tell you how to feel better, when you're not regulated and you have no capacity for connection. Yeah. So, but I think the reasoning part, the step three, and maybe step four, is reframe, because I think part of the healing of trauma is, how do I understand this in such a way that I don't diminish that it happened? How do I understand this in such a way that I'm not continuously hijacked by it? It's not making decisions for me. It's part of my autobiography, but it's not the all of who I am. And
yeah, I think that little grid that you just laid out of, you know, regulate, connect, reason, and then reframe. I don't know if that's your grid, but it's a pretty solid instruction to leaders, like what stage you're in, what type of work you're having to do. You can't skip any of these and expect good reaction.
You cannot. I mean, it's try it. Try to connect to someone who's dysregulated. I do a lot of work with Head Start. And part of the work I do with them is I work with the teachers and the staff around how to better understand children who are profoundly dysregulated. These are 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-olds who are profoundly dysregulated, creating tons of chaos in a classroom, like explosions, right? And how our first inclination is to sit them down and, why are you doing that? Stop doing that, you know, to try to reason with them about why they shouldn't be biting or spitting or punching or knocking bookshelves down. When where we have to start is with, again, relationally speaking, how can I use my nonverbals? How can I use the sound of my voice to contribute to their nervous system regulation first?
It's really interesting thinking about this as a parent and the masculine versus feminine ways of doing these stages. Like with boys, especially raising my son, his dysregulation was always too much energy, you know, wanting to physicalize and things like that. So there was no compassionate approach of, you know, accepting and hearing and kind of the, what I would consider the softer ways to regulate. For me, it was, no, get in and wrestle with him, pick him up and throw him, let him experience a bigger power than him that he could bang up against that didn't hurt him ever and doesn't, you know, seek to dominate him, is there, you know, as a play agent. But it's that I would, oh my God, I mean, I spent years and years throwing him into pools and onto beds and, you know, just wrestling with him. And that for boys, when I run into that, a dysregulated kid, that's what I always feel. I always feel like, oh, this guy needs a bigger dude around who sees him, values him, and will physicalize with him, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder if in that physical contact, if he was able to discharge, because part of regulating is I've got to discharge all this stuff that I don't know what to do with, especially at a young age. Right. And then he's calmer.
Right. And that's why it's like, I try to tell people, if you watch stuff like that from the outside, you don't understand that if you're doing it correctly, the male, the bigger person is letting this kid win some. It's letting him use his full power. It's letting them, you know, they can't let him go wild because it's sort of like the way puppies get socialized. They learn to play bite the first time they bite, the bigger thing loses its mind, go, no, don't do that. And so they learn ranges, but you've got to let them fully, like you said, discharge. And I think with leaders, especially in organizations, you don't see yourself having to do these things. And some people probably even resent having to do these things. You know, it's like, I just am here to give you instruction. I used to have this as a teacher a lot. I'm like, oh my God, they want me to be compassionate, don't they? You know, I can feel it.
Yeah, it's not, none of this is in your job description in leadership. You must be trauma informed. You must call upon your deepest interpersonal skills in order to manage people in the direction of success or high productivity or optimal results. I was giving a training the other day on empathy as your leadership superpower. And, you know, we've been hearing about this for decades, empathy, empathy, empathy. But unless you do a 90-minute, very deep dive into what it actually is and what it's not, most individuals don't really know what empathy is and have likely never even experienced it. So, but your capacity for empathy, true empathy, not sympathy, not even compassion, but true empathy, can play a critical role in regulating someone's nervous system. And when they're regulated, now we can begin the connection. Now that connection feels like it's grounded in some kind of trust and respect and maybe some genuine care.
That's really interesting. My kind of experience of you, you're a walking regulator.
Yes.
You emanate that.
So I would say yes to that. I would agree to that because there are times when I don't have to say anything. I can just walk in a room and someone will say, what is that? I feel better already. What is that? For me, that's executive presence. I think that executive presence, there are courses in executive presence, articles on executive presence. The nonverbal element of executive presence is invaluable. And I think from a communication studies perspective, it's something that we don't think about enough. You know, it's how does my mere being in the room with you or being in the Zoom with you, how does it make you feel? How do I make you feel? I don't think we ask that question enough. I think we assume that we have a certain kind of impact. Most leaders believe that their impact is positive. They believe that they're really, really great communicators, only to discover if they ask those they lead, they get a very different answer.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating. Again, like I'm a dysregulator for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, like I'm male, I'm muscular, I'm white, I'm bald, I'm rational. And I've had this experience of, I've been through it enough that I understand that my demographics, especially, nobody ever guesses what I do. Nobody ever looks at me and says professor of, you know, rhetoric, or they, you know, stand-up comedian. They never guess what I do. And even doing stand-up, like I did a cruise ship off the coast of Brazil, and it was mostly Brits, and the shows were so hard. And I was like, what's going on here? They're not reacting the way that I'm familiar with audiences reacting to me. And a British couple stayed after one of the shows, and they're like, we really enjoyed your show. But we didn't really get any of the references. And like, you're so American. And it never occurred to me that I was dysregulating this 80% of this audience just by being an American. And they immediately impose all these sort of ugly American things on you. And I'm like, that's not really me. And they're like, yeah, we kind of got that as you went through the show. But yeah, I think like demographically, and even I think with you, like the softer kind of approach to regulation, like being empathetic and being this sort of, you know, representation of a therapeutic modality of empathy and listening, that probably dysregulates a certain segment of the population. Where they're like, this is too soft, or this is too, you know, I don't do that kind of touchy-feely kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So you can't help the fact that you are, even if you want to be a regulator, you're kind of also a deregulator as you move through the world.
I think that's why I'm so deeply interested in neuroscience, because we can pull from neuroscience now to support all kinds of things. I think the last time I spoke with you on the podcast, I talked about the work of Richard Strozzi at the Strozzi Institute, who has a whole modality called embodied leadership. And it's all somatic work. It's all working with the body. It's these small tweaks in your posture and your facial expression that literally have a biochemical hormonal component that changes the person that's making these tweaks. So when I can change my energy, when I can self-regulate, it mostly is contagious. And can it deregulate others? Yes. When you can bring the science in, this is why I want you to do this thing that you're calling soft. I want you to just try it. Because when you do this, your cortisol level has just gone down. You're producing so much oxytocin right now that others are starting to perceive you as incredibly open rather than really defensive. Then they're willing to try. Like, oh, there's science attached to this. Maybe this isn't soft. And by the way, because I don't know if you've gotten this or not, but people will say, oh yeah, you're the soft skills person. Yeah, you teach
kind of integrating.
And I always say, no, I teach the essential skills. These are essential. So I take every opportunity to correct those moments. No, these are not soft. Empathy is not soft. Empathy is painful. If you're truly empathetic, you've got to sit in something that you're wanting to fix, change, resolve, dissolve. It's hard. It is not for the heart.
Right. Well, I think that's a great reframing. And I think one of the things that I like about your approach has always been that, yes, you will run through all these different modalities, but you're also very steeped in a scientific approach and a rigorous approach and an academic approach, Western rationality. And you don't mind going over there at all. You're like, oh, yeah, I'll wander over here if that's what you need to talk about. You know, yeah. You don't really, I mean, it's more of a, I think sometimes a rhetorical device to get people to lower their barriers and their prejudgments so they will accept the things that you've got to bring, mm-hmm. you know, but it's, you clearly walk well in both worlds.
Yeah. It's a practice. And I have to be fiercely committed to doing these things myself. I'm not going to teach you anything that I don't actually do myself. And I have been training on empathy for so long, only to have had an experience probably only four or five years ago, where I had the realization that I was empathetic for the first time.
Like, talk I was about like, that. Tell that story. That's very interesting.
This is, you know, I tell the story. I was at a very crowded restaurant, very, very crowded restaurant on a Friday or Saturday night with a dear friend of mine who had just lost her father. And she was in town because she came home for the funeral. And she was telling the story of, after having been estranged from him for many years, they finally had this Christmas where they really reconnected. There was a lot of hope in reestablishing this relationship. And he dies like 2 weeks later, just has a massive heart attack and he dies. And she's telling me the story at this restaurant. And this is an incredibly composed woman. The restaurant is crowded, there's a lot of activity, and she begins weeping, deep weeping. Like just guttural crying. And I had this moment where I knew I had a choice. I wanted to say things like, thank God you reconnected with him just 2 weeks ago. You're so lucky that he didn't suffer. I had a number of things running through my mind that I wanted to say to make her feel better about what was happening. And I knew how wrong that would be. And I was so uncomfortable. And the only thing I could think to do was to extend my hand across the table. And she took my hand and we sat there for a long time, which would, it felt like an eternity. It was probably only 90 seconds. And it was this willingness to just sit with her in that. For me, when I'm truly empathetic, it's almost like I have to sit on my own hands. I cannot fix this. I can't fix it. I can't change it. I can't resolve it. I can't make it different. I'm not going to talk you out of why you should feel some in another way. And this is what we do in the presence of someone who's suffering. We try to reduce the suffering when sometimes empathy is called for, which is being silent. And just sort of riding out that wave of emotion with that person and being willing to do that, that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, I, again, I come through things. We get to the same points. I think you and I work a lot of times on the same nodes of humanity and life and communication, but we come to it through different pathways. My son right now is, he's 21 and he's got a good job and they have good medical benefits. So he gets free therapy if he wants it. So he's been going to a therapist and cognitive behavioral therapist. You know what they do. They wander back through your life and they find pain points and they help you try to re-experience those and try to get to a better relationship with that was. But since I was a major part of his past, you know, especially as a kid, he's going back and revisiting things that have happened between us and finding the pain in them. And then every once in a while, we'll bring them to me, you know, like a cat, a dead mouse to your feet. and drop them there and go, what did you do this for? And I'm like, well, that is a hell of a good question. I said, you know, most parenting is trying to hide all the ugly stuff that you're dealing with in your life from your kids, trying to do no harm, you know, trying to give them a decent valence to grow up in, a decent emotional atmosphere. And then I do comedy. You know, I like to flood the room with as much happiness and joy and euphoria and craziness as I can. And that's kind of my approach to parenting. Now, if you were experiencing traumas from things like, I'm also very intellectual, so I will over-intellectualize whenever there's a problem. And I do not like to descend into empathetic suffering. I don't enjoy it. I've clearly had done it a lot in my life. I was married to a therapist, and that was, you know, her modality of, as I used to say, sometimes, not always, but sometimes it's hello, little fire. I am gasoline. Let's explore this emotion and expand it to get through it. And really, and I'm like, I get it. I understand that theory. But I, like I told my son, I'm like, that is not my approach. I'm super rationalist. Mm-hmm. I am super comic. And I'm super kind of just keep people in a safe atmosphere. When you needed more than that, I understand, but that wasn't me. And I tried to do a little bit of it when I can. I had the same thing with my daughter, who was very, very emotional and very empathetic and very suffering and much more melodramatic than I am. And I'm like, I can meet you there for about 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's so unnatural. It's so uncomfortable. I so dislike it. That I'm just like, I can give you this.
You know, our capacity for empathy is, we're hardwired for it because we know at some level that in addition to being able to fight, flee, and freeze to survive, we have to connect to survive. And I think it's then a matter of whether it's that natural capacity is cultivated. The example sure. I was giving most recently was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the claymation version. You know, when children watch it at a certain age, they get to this place where there's this scene where it's reindeer games. And it becomes clear that Rudolph is different. And I believe it's the female character, Clarice, is that her name?
Yeah.
Who kind of, you know, takes him off in another direction. And I don't know at what age it is. It might be somewhere between 3 and 4, where children are deeply moved by that moment, that they feel something. And that is a teachable moment for a parent to talk about, well, what would you have done? You know, compassion would be, I feel with you and I'm going to do something about it. That's compassion. There's action attached to compassion. Empathy is just, I'm going to be with you in this. And another learning or teaching moment in that little drama is the land of the misfit toys.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting when I brought that example into a group of senior level team members and executives, they all started shouting out what toy they were. Oh, I always identified as the doll or the Jack in the Box. And, but these are moments. I think Fred Rogers was, and what he offered was offered beautiful learnings along the way of empathy.
That's so funny.
But it's hard for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. My experience of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood growing up was I really disliked him.
Ah.
I'm like, speed it up, dude. I don't need you to talk down to me like this. You know, but I was one of those kids that was a fast processor pretty young and was growing up in a community in Kentucky, which was not a fast processor community. It was kind of a non-processor community in some ways. And so I didn't need more of that. I need somebody to be, you know, adultify the environment, not to kidify the environment. So.
Yeah. But these are things we don't learn along the way. And then we wonder why it's a superpower when it comes to leadership. If you can do it, if you're willing to do it, if you're willing to train up in it, if you're willing to practice it, I think it's like developing musculature in the gym. You just can't read about it, hear about it. You've got to actually do it. And yeah, sometimes the doing of empathy is, are you willing to say nothing?
It is, you know, again, it's easy to intellectualize it and see it, but sitting in pain with someone else, and I know people that are wonderful at it. I've got a business partner that I work with who has huge experience in the addiction communities and has learned over time that talk doesn't do that much. Mm-hmm. What does is sitting in the pain, mm-hmm. not trying to get out of the pain, you know, mm-hmm. not doing things to get out of it, just to sit there and do your work or whatever and accept that it's there until it naturally starts to ebb, until you naturally start to work your way through it. And I watch them do it. And I'm like, wow, that is so unpleasant.
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes neuroscience tells us that when we're sitting with someone who's in pain and they're in that big wave of emotion, a wave like that typically lasts no longer than 90 seconds. We don't realize that. We think if I sit here and I'm willing to sit here, I might be signing up for forever suffering. Or an individual who's unwilling to, for example, really, really feel grief, right? Like that idea, the only way out of this is through. And I've got to feel every bit of this. Those waves come and go, but we forget that, you know, no one is perpetually angry or perpetually grief-stricken. It comes and it goes. Now, it may come in 3 minutes later, but can you ride it? Ride it out to the other side. And as a parent, can you not stop it? You know, if I remember when we would fall, you know, and scrape our knee or whatever, and as soon as we would start to cry, my parents would go, shake it off, shake it off, shake it off. And it was so big. The reaction was so big that it totally was overriding any tears that would come up.
Right.
But wow, letting another human cycle something through to the end is such a gift to them.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's a great way to look at it. I think if you're going to be a leader, if you're going to take these positions of instructing the world and trying to model to the world, having a whole wheel of skills mm-hmm. is probably, you know, there's no way to avoid that. You need to be able to do that. You can't take this third of life, which is dealing with people's trauma and pain, and just be like, ah, it's not my thing. You can say that's not my thing, but you still need to understand how to move your way through it. Not that that's your primary thing that you offer the world, but I know in parenting, you see a lot of this stuff. Like, you don't realize you're going to have to be a psychotherapist when you sign up to be a parent. You're like, wait a minute, I can keep them safe or take them to doctors, but now I also have to deal with their complicated emotional reads. And sometimes, you know, it's a human being. Sometimes their emotions are completely askew from the moment. And you're like, what is that? Why are you, you know, but it is the sense of, I think if you're going to have that full wheel of skills, which a good leader has to have, you can't just ignore these things and function anywhere anymore. And I think that's, in some ways, that's a good thing in our modern culture, when you see like other modalities, other cultures, other subgroups just well up and go, no, I don't want to be ignored over here anymore. We're not going to function until you stop doing that. Mm-hmm. And then it does, you know, suddenly people do start paying attention to it, you know, more. Mm-hmm. I think with your stuff, one of the things that interests me is because it's so not in your persona now. But I know you grew up working class, right, in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And that's a very hard scrabble, much more like you're, you know, talking about much less empathy and all that kind of world. I don't think people would ever predict about you when they meet you now.
Oh yeah. I mean, even as we're talking, I'm looking across 3 yards into my parents' backyard, which is the yard I grew up in. And I returned to this place after being away for over 30 years but returned a different person. But any of the skills that I presently have and teach were cultivated very, very deeply, mostly in our discipline. I mean, I don't really know who I would be, what I would be doing had I not had this training. Because these,
down a little bit. I think it's in the frame. There you go. I'm
gonna get the sun?
You. No, you're, yeah, but you got lower some, so that you can't really.
What did I say?
There you go. Okay. You were saying that, you know, you were growing up like that and such a different person because of your training, coming through academics and coming through all your different trainings that you've taken. It's really altered you as a person.
I always knew that if I could master the art of relationship, like this is, I knew this as a young girl, if I could master the art of relationship, that I would be okay, that I would be better than okay. So I became a relational self-help junkie at a very young age. So there was definitely the seeds of that present for me. But our training in communication studies, especially the gift that we had to be able to study these things and apply them to human relationships, has just been so invaluable.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Again, my work right now it's much more public. Like when you look at the public identity that you're putting out there, like identity, as you've, I think, inferred or intimated quite a few times, is somewhere in the continuum between your inner world and your outer world, the way people react to you. Like as you try to pitch yourself as your inner best version that you want to be seen as, other people can accept that or reject it or, you know, be somewhere on the fence about it. And I see this a lot, like even in online dating now, you know, as a grown up, as a fully formed human, still talking to people. And it's this kind of speed evaluation of each other. It's like, what are you and what are you trying to present? But what's the real you back here? And human beings are constantly playing this vetting game with each other of trying to get through the things that you're presenting to somehow the authentic ongoing core self that you're going to be if I'm in a relationship with you, you know? And I think sometimes people distrust me because I work in rhetoric. I am a symbol molder, like crafter, manipulator, professional. Like I would know how to work symbols. I'm like, are you just presenting a self here version? And I'm like, no, I don't do that. I'm an ethical persuader. But they don't trust the training in some ways because everybody else does it so informally and kind of sloppily and non-intellectually. They're just, this is who I am. I'm like, yeah, okay.
So are you, what do you think about the notion of a core self, capital S self? An authentic self, because I think that given our training, especially cultural studies, social construction of reality, James Carey's work, communication as culture, that definition of communication, do you remember that? Communication is, yeah. And that plays very prominent in the work that I do, the power of communication to construct, maintain, repair, and transform identity. What do you believe about, is there a core? Is there an authentic self? Or are we always in that process of using communication to create, maintain, repair, transform? I mean, it's...
Yeah, it's, you know, do you want my rhetorician answer or do you want my real person answer?
Your real person answer.
Not sure they're separable at this point. I think there's, it's very hard to go against the evidence of the perseveration of some type of core self. Like, you wake up every day, you're not a brand new person because of something you thought or heard the day before. But you wake up as some small variation. You're constantly evolving the self. You're constantly fighting against certain versions of the self that you don't want to be. Mm-hmm. Like, I find binaries and dichotomies be very useful intellectually with a lot of this stuff. So the idea of my best self versus my worst self, that's a nice duality. And most people are fighting to get towards their best self, but it's a super struggle. Everything to try to get your behaviors and your emotions, your life in line with what you think you want to be. You see this, it's a massive amount of effort people are doing this in the world. Like, even just, I want to weigh a certain thing and you can see it, the best version of you physically. Can you stay on that path to that? Or does your worst self come in and grab control and constantly make you do things that fight the best self? And those are two clear visions of self that I think most people have. If you ask people, what are the worst things about you versus what are the best things about you, they could probably define it pretty easily. Go ahead.
I don't know if we talked about this the last time I was here, but throughout those years of COVID shutdown, I did training in internal family systems, IFS.
Yeah, you've mentioned it before. I'm not sure exactly what all that is, but yes.
So IFS is a therapeutic modality, and the belief behind it is that we have there's a multiplicity of mind, meaning that we are all constituted by parts. You know, there's the worst part of me, there's the best part of me, there's the rhetoric part of me, there's the teacher me, there's the daughter, there are all these parts. There's the anxious part, there's the anxious Christine, there's the meditative Christine, right? I could map out all of my parts. They all live in me, right? Like a big family. And I have parts that sometimes are not in my best interest. They sabotage me. They prevent me from success. They interfere in relationships. They, you know, when they come in, they create havoc and I want to get rid of them. I don't want them around. Well, in IFS, the belief is that all of your parts really do believe they're working on your behalf. Even the parts of yourself that you just wish you could bury. But at the center of it all, there is an authentic core self that has qualities of being that are calm, clear, capable of deep connection, capable of compassion, highly creative, really curious about the world, very confident and very courageous. And that we feel that we are in that pure, true self energy when most, if not all, of those C's are present. So if you were to think about the last time you were in a flow state, for example, the last time you were on stage and you were just knocking it out of the ballpark to the point where you lose sense of time, you lose sense of space, you are just so fully present. In internal family systems theory, we would say you were in that absolute self energy. And the question becomes, how do I manage my parts to be more fully that as often as possible?
Yeah, again, sort of as a rhetorician, two things there. I think all that's very useful, and I think that's a very strong you're back in the sunlight. Very strong rhetoric that a lot of people can hold on to. And that's not saying, when I say it's a rhetoric, I never mean that it's dismissible or superficial or whatever. I just mean it's a human construction. So this idea of a very stable, exalted core self, like a really core self that one would want, you know, those are all positive things that you're, hold on a second here. Sorry, I was about to sneeze. Which is great. I mean, especially if you're, I'm still going to sneeze. If you're selling something to people as a, something you want them to work to attain, something that you want them to accept, you definitely want that core self to be a positive thing, right? If that's the core of your offer, you don't want to be like, you know, your core self is this squishy, unreliable, cowardly, you know? So there's, I think that exaltedness of the core self as a positive is a rhetorical move. That's my first rhetorical read on it. The second part about you are parts, I completely agree with. In fact, one of the things we do when we build public identities for people is get them to understand that as a public figure, you are many things, but what you need to be in public is your one most attractant self to the target audience that you need to bring in order to have a business, or in order to have followers, or to have what you want. And so, yes, you are these other 75, 175 things, whatever. But the one that needs to be in public is the one that's your most viable for what you want. And that always goes back to rhetoric about, it starts with, well, what do you want here? Now design your messaging and your mind and your world and everything else to try to get that. And I think when you apply that to the idea of a core self, the idea that, yeah, I'd like to be that flow state self all the time. I think most people would say
a great deal of the time. I want that to be more of the rule rather than the exception.
Right. So you're always trying to move towards that. You're trying to align to that, which is, I call it beacon work, you know, and rhetoric. When you set a strong beacon, doesn't matter what you're working on, if it's a multiple team project, everybody working towards the same beacon. If you set the beacon right, you align all the work. If you set the beacon right for yourself, you align all your, at least what you're trying to do in your behaviors and the things that you're choosing, like choosing to do meditation today or choosing to yoga today. Like I start every day at the gym and then I go to the steam room for 15 or 20 minutes and I stretch and I sit and relax. And it realigns me with very little effort on my part. I don't have to do any cognitive work or emotional work. The behavior itself, the physicality of it, resets me for the day. Does it last all day? Sometimes. No, I don't know. But I know it's one of those things that's easy. Like it's uncomplicated.
Mm-hmm. So it resets you to the, what you experience as your optimal expression of self.
Yeah, I was on mute. Go ahead.
So it resets you to what you experience as a close to optimal version of self.
And a positive self, right? One that you enjoy, that gets you good things in the world, that lets go of some of the things that are traumatizing you and re-traumatizing you all the time.
Yeah, and that allows you to be with people and to do your work in the world in a way that is truly impactful and meaningful. You're doing your best work when you set your day up like that. Like you're actually creating a certain level of insurance that you will probably show up in your work and with others in a highly beneficial way when you do something like that. And that's what works for you.
So how much of your, give yourself a percentage estimate. Are you in flow? Like, are you able to pull this off versus still struggling to pull it off? So I think sometimes like when you see guru people and their big offer, their public offers of serenity and flow state and happiness and dealing with trauma, there's that disconnect between what you're painting and what you yourself are experiencing. Not saying that you're doing that, but I'm just curious as to, like, because you work in this a lot of offering people a better experience of their selves and their life. Like, here's a pathway to that, people, you know?
I have two answers to that. It's a colleague of mine said yesterday, because I did a big presentation yesterday, and she said, "Christine, you are the only person I know that can just blow it out of the ballpark and then later say, oh my gosh, I've been vomiting all morning." You know, or, you know, my dog ran away this morning. So I can perform, right? However, the way that I have chosen to redesign my life at all levels, has created for me the opportunity to be more effortlessly in that state. At present, I don't do any work that I don't absolutely love. That's huge. I'm more willing to say no to things that I'm certain would make me unhappy or very stressed. I'm very intentional about my relationships and which ones I really nurture and cultivate and the others that I've kind of let go of. And so I think the older I get, the closer I get to, I said this to myself just recently, could have been yesterday, the day before, I feel more fully myself at, I'll be 58 next month or in February, than I ever have. And I can look back at all the suffering, like the decades of suffering where I wasn't. I would have glimpses of it, but I think I feel most me when I'm teaching or speaking.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Me too. Like something about, I used to explain to people, I've never had a single iota of public speaking anxiety. The experience of being in conversation with, you know, 20, 50, 1,000 people at the same time feels right. Like it just makes me feel like, oh yeah, this is the way I like to talk to multiple consciousnesses at the same time.
But I think that those moments where you think, oh, this is right. I am in flow. I think it hints to the fact that you're resonating with something that I don't know that we even have a word for. We call it self, but it's, there's such an alignment and such a resonance that it feel you're, that's a great word for it. This feels right.
Well, I think, yes, I think when you talked about, I think as you get older, you realize the power of moving things out of your life. Mm-hmm. And I figured out this fairly early because on my earlier version of the podcast, early episode, I had a friend of mine who still lives in Kentucky and loves Kentucky. And I played Persuade the Persuader. And I said, the whole episode was him trying to persuade me to move back to Kentucky. I'm like, yeah, give it a shot. I'm totally open to your persuasion. I'm a wide open receiver. Give it your best. And we went through it for an hour. It was super fun. But I'm like, there's no way I'm ever going to move back to Kentucky because I know the good parts of Kentucky. And I know the parts where I grew up in sort of the South End working class, sort of poor whites out of Kentucky. And those good parts of Kentucky did not filter down really to where I was. And I didn't like having to fight my culture all the time to be a valued self. Like, you know, it's the old Bill Hicks stand-up routine about what we got here, a reader, you know, like the fact that I was an intellectual kid in a non-intellectualizing culture was constantly disfigured. It's constantly unpleasant. And so when I got to grad school, and UT Austin was the very first time I was ever around a super intellectualized community, and the first grad party, and there was 100 people there or whatever, and grad students and professors, I'm like, oh my God, you just feel how smart this room is. It feels awesome. And so I think I moved out of Kentucky and I moved things out of my life. And for the last 2 years, I have a little presentation working on, I think, called 2 Years a Hermit. And basically, before I started doing the cruise ships, my kids left about halfway through the pandemic. One moved to France and one moved to San Diego. And so I was in this big house in Texas by myself. And I was there for 9 months. And then I moved back to California in a nice little one bedroom on the beach. And I haven't really filled my life back up on purpose, because I wanted to feel like what it felt like to not have anything pulling me in other directions for a couple of years, other than my work and things that interested me and going to the gym. And it's, I don't think I'd do this forever, but it's been so self palate cleansing, you know, and so restorative that I'm like, oh, this has been an awesome 2 years of hermiting.
You know, it reminds me of, I made a very intentional decision after my divorce that I would not even entertain the notion of another relationship for 2 years.
See, 2 years of hermit.
Except it's now 4, right? Be careful. But it's the best decision I ever made. Because, and this is another topic, maybe for another episode, what I really have gotten clarity about is the nuances of the intrapersonal relationship. And working very intentionally on getting to know my interior world and applying the principles and the practices of interpersonal relationship building to myself, to the intrapersonal. And it's something I've been writing about, speaking about. In fact, it's the subject of my keynote, but it has come out of this 2+ years of solitude. I mean, I'm out in the world working and I see family, right, and I've spent a lot of time alone and have released a lot of things, like certain relationships, but also just things. Like if you walked into my house, you wouldn't know if I was moving in or moving out.
Right.
Sure. And it's, you know, it's okay. Nothing is going to go on that coffee table until I decide the right thing that's going to go on that coffee table. It's everything very intentional and less. Everything is less. And I love it.
Well, I think it simplifies the process of when you can move enough things out and you can start to make singular decisions with time, with contemplation, and with feeling. Does this feel right? You can test it. You can move things around. But life gets so complicated and relationships, oh my God, just, you know, exponentialize the complication every time you add another human being into your intimate circle.
Right.
And you're like, wow, I spent so much energy and time with these two humans that I raised 50% of the time by myself in my house. And you're like, they're gone. And you're like, oh man, you don't realize like how much of yourself is being pulled this direction and that direction. But when you're by yourself, you're like, huh, I keep doing this one thing this way. I wonder why. And because there's patterns, you're not just reactive patterns. You're not getting stretched out of your patterns by other people.
Yeah.
And so really, I'm not sure you find an authentic self, but you find a different, a cleaner kind of more singular self. And that's been great.
Yeah. I think it grants a lot of clarity. I mean, I would do things. I'd have a glass of red wine and I would ask myself, do you really like red wine? Like, where did this come from? you know, this sort of inquiry that has been, and then pouring it down the drain and realizing, no, I like Chardonnay. You know?
Yeah, so. There's a very important, some very important decision, self-decision. What kind of wine do I like? Well, this has been great. I always enjoy talking to you. I think there's tons of value in the episode about thinking about your side of the world and some really strong programmatic stuff. Tell people what they can, how they can hire you for your keynote. You can reach out to you for consulting. Do a little self pitch.
ChristineKeisinger.com. Go straight there. Everything you need and want to know is right there, and reach out.
Mm-hmm. Reach out. Reach out to the woman living simply in her partially transitional, partially stable life and existence. I definitely encourage people to. I think you have so much to offer. It's kind of endless.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. This was great. I forgot we were podcasting, which is always a sign of a great podcast.
Yeah. Good conversations, right? That to me is so much fun. Like be able to go back and revisit people that I've known for a long time and that I get to talk to so rarely. This at least focuses it and gives it a good reason, a good pragmatics, I think. So I like it. Well, this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Go visit Christine. Go talk to Christine. We will talk to you soon. And get out there and persuade people. They always need it.